Have you ever felt, have you ever left a medical exam feeling that your doctor didn't really listen to you? Have you ever switched physicians in search of someone you felt would be more caring? Danielle Ofri has given a lot of thought and study to the communication problems between doctors and their patients, and her new book, What Patients Say When Doctors, What Doctors Hear, probes what goes wrong in the exam room, the impact that it has on the care we get, and what both doctors and patients can do to improve those exchanges. Danielle Ofri is a physician at Bellevue Hospital, a professor at NYU School of Medicine. Her book is published by Beacon Press, and I'm very pleased it has brought Dr. Ofri back to our show. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Why do you say the conversation between doctor and patient is the most important diagnostic tool of all?
What the patient brings to the doctor is really their story, what's been happening, what they feel. And for the doctor to make the diagnosis, it's really how the patient describes the story. And if we don't listen carefully, we miss the most important clues and end up ordering unnecessary tests, going down the wrong diagnostic paths, and are often prone to medical error.
Does it matter whether it's our regular doctor or someone that we're seeing at a clinic or at an emergency room?
For every situation, even specialties that are visually based like dermatology or orthopedics that are physically based, still the patient's story of how the situation came to be makes a big difference in what the diagnosis is.
Why do many patients, when they're asked about it later, not know the name of their own diagnosis or even the name of the doctor?
Seems amazing, isn't it? But patients are receiving so much information in a visit, their diagnosis, the test, the workup, the possible situations, referrals, that it's hard to remember, especially if you're in pain, if you're sick, if you're worried, nauseous, freezing. It's often hard to remember everything the doctor says.
Do the doctors have any idea about this lack of knowledge?
I think we do know. We understand that, for example, something like less than half of patients take their medications as directed. So we know that even though we think we're giving the information clearly, that it's not always getting across.
Doesn't communication start a breakdown even before the visit begins, when the patient has to wait a long time before being able to see the doctor?
Sure. I mean, by the time the patient gets there, they've often waited weeks, sometimes months for the appointment, then an hour or longer in the room, and they're anxious and nervous. So it already breaks down before we even start.
And then the doctor usually starts the consultation by asking the patient, what brings you here today? How do patients typically respond to that question or try to respond?
Well, patients usually start with something like, you know, I've been having this pain in my stomach. But then we doctors, we interrupt within about 10 seconds and start running down the path of when did it start, how long have you had it, and the patient may not have gotten out the second thing that's on their mind, which may be the most important thing, and our tendency to interrupt. And I think it's not because we're trying to be rude. We want to be efficient and get the patient down the right track, but we often can miss the most important information.
So while patients want to explain their illness as a story with a plot and start at the beginning, how do doctors explain their illnesses, especially since they don't seem to be all that patient enough to listen to the complete story?
Well, doctors often, as the patient speaks, quickly categorize what's going on very rapidly, make a quick diagnosis, and already start onto the plan. I mean, I think most doctors tend to run ahead to what needs to be done. Here are the 16 things that need to be done. Let's get on them now. We may have missed what the patient was really trying to say.
Is it helpful or off-putting when a patient arrives for a doctor visit with a list of questions?
Depends how many questions. So I think that having a list of questions helps, but you need to be realistic. If you have 40 items on your list, you'll only get a superficial treatment of each one. So I tell patients, yes, make a list, but be realistic. You can really only do two or three of in any sort of depth.
Often pertinent medical information can be personal and even embarrassing. How can doctors overcome the patient's reluctance to discuss matters like that?
Well, the most important thing, I believe, is establishing a very comfortable, trusting relationship. So, for example, when we first talk to a patient, to make full eye contact, even just for a minute, rather than go to our computer and start writing, gives a chance the patient to be heard. And often I find that when I go do the physical exam, when I'm away from the computer and we're actually touching and talking without the intrusion of technology, that's when patients feel comfortable saying what's really on their mind. Sometimes the more embarrassing things or uncomfortable things come out at that moment.
But you also say that there's a hand on the door phenomenon where patients wait until the moment that they're leaving the office to bring up the most important issue.
probably because doctors haven't made the environment receptive enough. But the patient feels they have to get this out. And so it only happens as they're about to walk out into the real world and leave this one last chance with the doctor. And it's a very common phenomenon.
Aren't there many issues that affect patient health that aren't traditionally thought of as medical, like emotional stress or financial problems? Are doctors equipped to even address them?
I think that we at least need to acknowledge them. For example, if a patient isn't taking their medication because it costs too much, we need to know that. And the patient may be embarrassed to admit that, but if we're not aware, we wouldn't know to prescribe a different medication. So while we can't solve the socioeconomic issues, being aware of what's adding to the patient's difficulty in getting treatment is very key for us.
Are doctors unaware of how expensive pharmaceuticals are these days?
Well, we know they're expensive, but we often have no idea what a given patient pays, which insurance plan covers what needs prior approval, what's first tier, second tier. We can't keep track of that. No one can.
How did you eventually realize why your patient, Gaspar Navarro, wasn't taking his medications properly, even though you'd clearly labeled them for him?
This was a patient I had with difficult-to-control diabetes, and every visit he would come back not taking his meds, and I would make a clear list, write it better, clearer. It took more than a year for him to admit that he couldn't read, and I had no idea because I'd never asked, and he was too embarrassed to admit that.
But you were spelling it out for him, weren't you?
Well, I was writing down the names and making a list. And, of course, if he couldn't read, he couldn't necessarily match it up. And I realized that I was missing the most important reason why he couldn't take his medications.
My guest is Dr. Danielle O'Free. Her latest book, What Patients Say, What Doctors Hear, it's from Beacon Press. This is WMYC, WMYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. The issue of time in the exam room comes up repeatedly in your writing here. Do doctors tend to have less time than they used to?
I think we have about the same amount of time, but there's so much more to address in a visit. On the one hand, patients in general are just sicker. There are more chronic illnesses, so much more to deal with. There's also
Why are there more chronic illnesses? Because people are getting older?
People are living longer. People used to die much younger of a heart attack or a stroke or an infection, but now we treat these illnesses, so people live longer with their chronic diabetes and hypertension. On the other side, we now have much more to document in the visit. The electronic medical record, which helps in many respects, also can add many requirements. We must address pain scores and depression, education level, language barriers, asthma action plan, HIV screening, all of which are very important, but make it very difficult to get everything done in the narrow amount of time.
So a doctor has to figure out how to best use the time that he or she has?
So we have to prioritize just like the patient. And I may choose to focus on one particular part of my patient's conditions on this visit because I can't get to it all. It will help if I say, hey, today, let's focus on your blood pressure and let's leave, you know, the cholesterol and the diabetes, you know, for the next time we get together, or let's focus on your diet and exercise.
But in many cases, aren't you seeing a patient one time?
Well, no, we have follow-up. I mean, the nice thing about being a primary care doctor is that patients come back. And so we can see each other every 3 to 4 months, and it's an ongoing relationship, hopefully over years.
You write that doctors learn 10,000 new words over the course of their training. How does that affect their ability to communicate with people who don't have this specialized knowledge and vocabulary?
Doctors often forget that much of our terminology isn't real English. We'll say terms like MI, meaning myocardial infarction or heart attack, but forget that patients don't know what an MI is. And we use it so much, it's so ingrained in us that we don't recognize that we're using foreign terminology. So patients may nod as though they're understanding, but really not get what we're saying.
And then so doctors will commonly say that a patient has failed chemotherapy, which sounds like they're blaming the patient. Why not just simply say that the cancer is resistant to chemotherapy?
Or the chemotherapy didn't work, or the chemotherapy failed the patient. And again, this is a lot of the standard way medical histories are written. For example, we'll say a patient denies being short of breath. Sounds like a courtroom drama. They just didn't have shortness of breath, but that's the way we express it in the written medical record.
So are these just bad habits, or do they reveal how doctors think about their patients?
Well, it's somewhat of a cultural issue. There's a whole culture of medicine, including a language, a way of speaking, a way of being, a way of dressing, that we're so acculturated to that we don't recognize that other people don't realize this.
And then there are other problems, I would imagine. Is it better to call a patient obese and risk hurting his feelings, or to say that your weight may be damaging your health and risk being thought of being patronizing.
It's an interesting conundrum. There's some research suggests that although some patients find the term obese insulting, many patients find it more concerning than overweight and makes them more likely to make changes. So I think we have to be careful in how we say it, but some anxiety about the illness helps you make a change.
Can't you just say you're quite overweight and you have to bring it down a bit?
Part of it, I think, is finding for an individual patient what works and getting a sense of what will help them make a change. And using a term like obese can be off-putting to many patients. So I will tend to say, you know, your weight is more than it should be, and it would be helpful for you, for your blood pressure, if your weight came down.
And wording can be really sensitive in all sorts of ways. Aren't some people proud to call themselves cancer survivors while others are uncomfortable with the implications of being a survivor?
So that's it. Again, some of these have political overtones, and I tend to try be as neutral as possible. A patient who has had cancer is what I'll say. And if they say cancer survivor, then I'll use that term and kind of match their level.
Since doctors are trained to scope out the chief complaint, what are the challenges of treating a patient who has a number of different symptoms that may or may not be related?
So the patient who comes in with 20 or 30 complaints is a very big challenge because one of them may be critically important and many may not be. What I'll often say to a patient is, you know, you have lots on your mind. We can't realistically hit them all. Let's pick the top three. You pick two and I'll pick one. So I make sure that I find the one on the list that I think is the most life-threatening that I want to make sure we're addressed, and the patient picks their priorities as well.
You write about Morgan Amanda Fritzlin. She had 26 separate diagnoses.
She was an unusual a patient who had some many legitimate and quite rare illnesses. And I think she would be an unusual outlier in that sense. But she was a patient, very intelligent woman. She's part of how I came to write the book. I had the unique opportunity to interview her as well as her physician and hear them both tell the story of the same events. And I was fascinated that the stories were quite different. It was like a movie scene with two different cameras. Even though both were very thoughtful, self-reflective, yet they saw things very differently.
Well, who was closer to accurate?
I mean, having not been there, I can't say. I think they were both accurate. I think ultimately that was my lesson, that both stories were accurate. They both contained elements of truth, and that pulling it together and finding where the miscommunications happened is part of what makes the best medical care.
You report that doctors didn't want to treat her. Was her case just seen as simply too complex?
Well, certainly patients with very complicated illnesses, many patients are nervous about taking them on. You still get the same 15 minutes. They don't expand your time from a sicker patient. And when conditions are very time intensive, it can be a little off-putting.
Well, like many educated long-time patients, Morgan Amanda was very well read on her condition. And today, I'd imagine doctors have to contend with the fact that people go online and suddenly are self-diagnosing, perhaps accurately, sometimes inaccurately. Do many doctors find those kinds of patients difficult and opinionate?
It's a double-edged sword. So if patients who come in with some knowledge can be very helpful to make the treatment of the illness, you know, move a little more efficiently. But sometimes patients will come in with lots of misinformation. It's very hard to distinguish on the web what's accurate, what's not. And some patients will come in with a 3-foot stack of materials thinking that we can go through them all, which just is not realistic.
On the other hand, patients now feel a bit better about not having doctors act like they are gods.
Right. I think that no one in the room is God. And you know, it is a team sport. But it doesn't mean that doctors should abandon their role of being an advocate and giving, if they have an honest opinion about one treatment versus another, we should express that, not say, well, you just decide for yourself. That's not really, you know, being an advocate.
Despite good intentions on the part of both patient and doctor, don't they have to stop working together sometimes?
In the sense of when they have to part ways if they have disagreements?
Well, yeah. Well, one of them has to wind up having the final say.
I mean, hopefully you're able to
Like Morgan Amanda left her doctor.
Right. So it may be that some people need to find a different doctor who works on their wavelength. But I think usually you can come to an agreement that represents, you know, both of your priorities in there.
My guest is Danielle Ofri. Her latest book is What Patients Say, What Doctors Hear. It is published by Beacon Press. And we'll talk more with Dr. Ofri after we take a little break. Stay with us. And we're back with Dr. Danielle Ofri. Her latest book, What Patients Say, What Doctors Hear, it is published by Beacon Press. What are some of the challenges you have that you've encountered while treating your patients at Bellevue?
Well, Bellevue is a wonderful and interesting hospital. We have patients from all over the world. So one challenge is language. This morning I had a patient who spoke Burmese, and I was trying to track down a Burmese interpreter by phone, which turned out not to be possible. So I had to use a relative. So there are language challenges. There's often socioeconomic issues that may add into it.
They're uninsured often, indigent.
Some are uninsured, some are indigent. Many are working, but working in jobs that don't provide insurance. And many certainly right now are very nervous about the issue with immigrants and immigration and the repeal of ACA. It affects them directly.
And what about the initial image that you have? A patient walks in and is very seriously overweight, is obese. It's my sense that some doctors kind of have a bias against them.
I think all people have biases, and certainly doctors are no exception. Our challenge is to try and do a blank slate as much as possible, because we tend to look at obesity as self-inflicted and maybe this patient just isn't working hard enough, and to try and take that part out because it doesn't really help us achieve our goal of helping this patient get better health.
Tell us about the Canadian study for the treatment of back pain.
This was a fascinating study to me. I mean, this is a study in which patients went for physical therapy and they received electrical stimulation, a very common treatment. But for half the patients, the machine was never turned on, called sham treatment. And those patients with a fake machine actually had a 25% reduction in pain relief.
If they turn the placebo effect.
It works quite nicely. When they turn the machine on, they have a 45% reduction in pain. So the machine actually works. But then they further divided the groups, and half the physical therapists were absolutely silent, and some, the other half, were engaged, talking to the patients about their pain, how it's affecting their life, how they might get better, being optimistic, being encouraging. And the patients who had engaged physical therapists but with the machine completely off had a 55% reduction in pain, more than the machine alone.
But I know that as a potential patient, if I was told that I had been given a placebo, I would be really upset.
Interestingly, a lot of patients aren't. Ted Kapchuk up at Harvard in the placebo studies program, he did an experiment with patients with irritable bowel syndrome where he gave them a placebo and said, this is a placebo, but research shows that placebos help relieve pain, and a significant amount had improved pain. And one of my patients once said, I don't care if it's a dill pickle. If it relieves my pain, I'm happy to have it. And certainly placebos have many fewer side effects.
But the placebo also suggests that this is in our heads. It's not really a truly physical condition.
Not quite, because the placebo effect does activate things in our bodies, endorphins, cortisol levels. When we do studies with placebos and patients are using MRIs of their brain, we can see areas light up of the pain areas, even with just placebos and communication.
How do you respond when patients ask if a multivitamin will give them more energy?
It's a funny thing. You know, in the past, I would always say, you know, it's a waste of money, a waste of time, unless you have a vitamin deficiency. But now that I've read the research, I will say, you know, many of my patients have said that they get much more energy with a multivitamin. It's worth a try because there's not much downside. And inevitably, a few patients come back and feel better.
Is that the placebo effect?
I believe so. And if I'm not replacing another required medication, and if it helps them, I think it's actually a very helpful, legitimate medical intervention.
I'm sure that when you read the medical journals and see what the latest research reveals, you think back to a time when you were told the exact opposite in treating patients.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, take estrogen. We used to always prescribe estrogen to, you know, prevent heart disease, and then we stopped prescribing because now it causes heart disease. So we're constantly having to, you know, rethink how we explain to patients.
Diseases like diabetes and hypertension require patient participation to take their medication regularly and to control their diets. Why is adhering to a medical plan often so difficult for people? I can imagine that stabbing yourself with a needle if you have diabetes might be something you might prefer not to do.
Well, there are many reasons. Many of the pills cause a lot of side effects. They can make people nauseous, have diarrhea, affect their sexual function. The medications can be, as we mentioned, prohibitively expensive. They can be embarrassed to use their syringe in public. There may be family pressures to not be taking pills. So there are many, many reasons. And often doctors say, are you taking your meds? And patients will say, yeah. But if we say, you know, a lot of patients sometimes have trouble taking medications. Do you ever have trouble taking yours? The patient might be more likely to reveal difficulties in taking the medication.
And I always wonder about those commercials on television where after they show you these happy people, they then say, if you have some illness, do not do it, or this might lead to suicidal thoughts. Or I would imagine that a lot of people would be afraid to take those medications. Do they come to you and ask you for them after they've seen the ads on television?
Yes, in fact, both responses. So one, if people come and say, I saw this on TV, you know, can I get this? Or I heard about these horrible side effects. I never want to take this, but I'll take these supplements. And I try to make the case that all things you put in your body, vitamins, supplements, or medications, all have side effects, and do the risks, you know, outweigh the benefits?
Do patients prefer to get written instructions that they can take home with them?
I think it should be both. Written is very helpful. The medication list, you know, writing down the next three appointments, as well as reiterating verbally the three most important points of the visit.
Then there's always the matter of, oh, I was supposed to take that pill at 7 o'clock. I forgot. Should I take it now? It's 11.
Right. It's very difficult. I mean, we send home patients with multiple medications. I used to do an experiment with my medical students, have them write prescriptions, and then we would give out boxes of Tic Tacs and give them each three prescriptions to take for a week, and not one could do it. And they realized that it's very hard to take a twice-a-day medication, three times a day medication, one without meds, one with meals. It's very hard to do.
How do doctors deal with their discomfort at having to deliver bad news?
Nobody wants to deliver bad news. I mean, to tell someone that you have a serious disease, you might die or you will die, that's a very just humanly difficult thing. And often the reaction of doctors, maybe unconsciously, is we try to get it over as fast as possible and jump right onto the plan. Well, here are the X things to do, whereas the patient has stopped listening. Once you've said cancer or stroke, they don't hear anything.
Because they need time to process what
I think our
just
brain
heard.
Often shuts down once we hear this terrible news.
As a result, don't patients often fail to absorb any information after they've heard the bad
news? That's a very, very common reaction. So we suggest for doctors to give enough time for the diagnosis part before the plan and to make sure the patient has enough time to absorb it, understand it, before you go on to the 16 things that happen next.
When a patient asks, how much time do I have left? Doctors tend to respond with statistics and averages. That doesn't always satisfy.
Not at all, because it doesn't help that individual patient. Now, the truth is, doctors and medical science were terrible prognosticators. Our data will give us five-year averages, but doesn't tell us what will happen for you, the one single person. So I try to give patients a range and then maybe offer something like, I think we should hope for the best, but also plan for the worst. So let's keep both possibilities in mind so no one gets surprised if an illness starts to progress more rapidly than we'd expected.
You tell a story in the book about how early in your career you made an error when you failed to read a CT scan. What happened to the patient?
So this was a patient admitted when I was a resident at Bellevue. This was during the height of the AIDS epidemic, and it was very, very busy. And so one of the things we tried to do to survive the multiple admissions is to kind of transfer patients as quickly as possible. In the middle of the night, we got an elderly gentleman with, quote, altered mental status. You know, a guy from a nursing home, a little more demented, and his labs were fine, radiology fine. So I quickly tried to turf this guy to a holding unit, just get him back to his nursing home. And I told the doctor, just take him quickly. He's fine. Labs fine. Radiology fine. Turns out the next day that, in fact, he was bleeding in his head. And I'd missed it because I hadn't read the CAT scan. Somebody had said radiology fine, and I didn't read the scan myself. Now, luckily, someone else saw the scan. The patient got taken to the OR and was treated fine. So, in fact, the patient's care was not impacted. So this was a near-miss error. Yet I'd still made the error. Had I sent the patient home, they could have been dead.
And then doctors sometimes dismiss things. A friend of mine had a pain in his back, and the doctor said, you just have to do some exercises. He also happened to go to a chiropractor who said, no, I'm feeling something here. He went back to his doctor. The doctor said, you should change chiropractors, after he sent him to another doctor who agreed that it was just normal back pain. The second chiropractor said, no, I think the first chiropractor was right. They did x-rays or CAT scans or whatever, and it turned out he had a serious cancer. And if he had not gone to the chiropractor, chiropractors are dismissed by most mainstream medicine, he'd be dead.
I mean, you point out it's often very difficult to make a diagnosis like that. I mean, everyone has back pain, and maybe 0.5% will have back pain from a cancer. So picking that out, in short of doing a CAT scan on every single person, which is not realistic, can be difficult. So that's where asking the story very clearly, trying to distinguish the very subtle distinctions between the back pain caused by cancer and that by muscle strain can be teased out.
You never told your supervisor about your error.
No, because I was just too embarrassed. I was humiliated. I had not done due diligence for my patient. And I know why I didn't. I was too ashamed. But I look back now and think, what a missed opportunity to have my supervisor educate me on how not to make the error, how to talk to a patient about a mistake. Yet I was just not, could not bring myself to come forward.
Do hospitals accept that a certain number of lawsuits are going to be part of the cost of doing business?
Well, the goal is to minimize them as much as possible. And I think now we're moving much more toward transparency, to being honest with patients. But, you know, we can make laws and protocols, but if we don't address the shame and embarrassment, it's hard for people to come forward.
What are the most common reasons patients sue their doctors? You write about a Mrs. Benson, a woman whose husband died because of a medical error.
So if you look at the data, most patients ultimately are suing over information issues. They feel they did not know what was going on. And only a small percentage is the true malpractice that we think of, the thing that was done incorrectly, because doctors often clam up, understandably, perhaps. But in this case, the patient had a central line, a big IV line put in their neck, and puncturing the lung is a rare but known complication. This happened, and it was a dreadful, you know, conflagration of events. The patient died. But for the wife, no one told her what happened, and that is what made her so upset and angry. And until someone acknowledged that the doctor not only knew about the error and felt grievously terrible about it, and it haunted him every day, that she understood that he felt that, could she have any sort of peace?
And doctors complain that that insurance is one of the biggest things they have to deal with. So how do you get past that? What's the goal of an organization like Sorry Works?
So Sorry Works is an organization that was pointing out that when doctors do come forward with errors, then in fact patients are much less likely to sue. And it has definitely been shown, because again, most patients want to know what happened. And if you explain to patients, here's what happened, here was the error, here's what we're doing to make sure it doesn't happen again, most patients don't want to go through a lawsuit. It's horrible for patients as it is for doctors.
Doctors also complain that fear of lawsuits is a reason that they have patients go through many more tests than they might need.
It's defensive medicine's become an inordinate source of expense. We overorder CAT scans or MRIs for every patient with back pain, because if we miss the one with cancer, we will be sued. And again, if we spend a little more time listening to the patient, we might be able to A, avoid unnecessary tests, but B, if an error happens, the patient's much more likely to understand and accept the reasoning behind it and probably less likely to sue.
Bellevue is a public hospital that serves a disproportionately low-income and immigrant patient population. What kind of impact do you think initiatives like the repeal of the Affordable Care Act and the refugee ban will have on your patients and general practice there?
So our patients are very worried, if not for themselves, then for their family members. It's a big concern, and I think it also makes patients a little more fearful of going to the doctor and leaving things and, you know, to the last minute. Because preventative care really makes a difference. We want our patients to come on a regular basis and not be afraid to come, but many are concerned they might lose their coverage.
What advice would you give to a patient who senses that her doctor isn't being responsive?
So one thing, it's okay to say, like if a doctor is busy typing, not listening, you could say, hey, could you give me a minute to get my story out? I know you have a lot to do, but just give me 1 minute and I'll get it all out. And I think most doctors are willing to stop what they're doing and pay attention.
But then is it reasonable for someone to say, you know, I really want a different doctor?
That's, if your doctor really isn't listening, you should get another doctor. There's enough out there.
Can empathy and communication skills be taught at medical school?
I believe they can be taught. How they can't be taught is, you know, our typical medical education with a PowerPoint presentation and an exam on this. How it's really taught is really almost one-on-one or small group with a physician who goes to the bedside and shows how best to talk with the patient, how to deal with a difficult patient, how to break bad news, and seeing it in real time. And we can learn this not just from other doctors, but from nurses, from physical therapists, from nutritionists who spend a lot of time with patients.
Often the people who've gone through some kind of a clinic or emergency room remember the names of the nurses, but they don't remember the names of the doctor.
Probably because nurses spend much more time with patients. They also spend more time touching the patients, whereas doctors, we stand back and cross our arms and talk from a distance. Nurses are much closer to their patients.
In the old days, doctors made house calls, and so we had a very different feeling of our relationship with them. They, in some cases, they were people we felt we knew.
Indeed. And there is some
resurgence.
You think
something's been lost?
I do believe so. There's a resurgence in house calls, but the whole idea of primary care medicine, I mean, I have a few patients at Bellevue who have been my patients for 20 years, and we know each other very well, and I feel as though because we know each other that if my patient comes in and something's wrong, I can pick it up quite quickly because I know him by now.
Do you, what response have you been getting from this book? Do doctors read it and say, right on, or do they say, oh, Danielle, you shouldn't have revealed that?
Well, certainly patients. It resonates a lot with patients because the idea of not being heard is such a common complaint and a big fear. And the truth is most doctors recognize that communication is very difficult and wish they weren't forced to multitask so much so they could listen more.
You'll be signing books and talking tomorrow night at 7 o'clock at the Barnes & Noble store on 82nd Street and Broadway. I'm assuming some of your former patients will show up.
Maybe some and some staff and other friends.
Meanwhile, if you want to read this book, which is just fascinating, it's What Patients Say, What Doctors Hear from Beacon Press. My great thanks to Dr. Danielle Ofri for being on our show again. It's always a pleasure to see you, even though some of the things you reveal can be a little scary at times.
Thank you, Leonard.